Hello, it's Thursday, September the 9th, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, there's a new twist in the saga of Geronimo, the alpaca. He's not resting in peace. We're talking about Portugal. Should Britain follow Portugal's example and decriminalise all drugs? Also, the World Health Organization says rich countries, they mean the UK, should hold back on booster vaccines to help vaccinate poorer parts of the world. But first, and the most extraordinary panel of people who've been victims of Metropolitan Police incompetence, to say the very least, have rallied together in the Daily Mail to say Cressida Dick, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, she has to go. An extraordinary photograph in the Daily Mail today, a panel of victims, high profile some of them, of police corruption, incompetence and malpractice. And they all called for the resignation of the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Cressida Dick. The group are Baroness Doreen Lawrence, Lady Diana Britton. Her husband was the former Home Secretary, Leon Britton. Harvey Proctor was a Conservative MP. Paul Gambaccini, still a disc jockey for Radio 1. Nick Bramall, the son of Lord Bramall, who was the Chief of Defence Staff. And the former Prime Minister Edward Heath's biographer, Michael McManus. I'm joined now by Stephen Wright, the Daily Mail's Associate Editor, who brought this extraordinary group of people together. Stephen, just tell me how they're united in their criticism of the Metropolitan Police Commissioner.
Well, they all feel that they have been let down by the Metropolitan Police and that no one has been held to account for their sort of individual sort of grievances against the police, their experiences. So with Lady Britton, you know, 6 weeks after her husband died, police officers raided her home in Pimlico and in North Yorkshire on the lies of Carl Beach, a.k.a. Nick. Shocking.
The fantasist.
Yeah. I mean, shocking abuse of power. Chief Magistrate who granted the search warrant says he was misled by the police. So without getting into too much detail, yeah. I mean, the chief was really let down.
Of course.
No accountability in the Met over that operation. Doreen Lawrence, Baroness Lawrence, you know, someone admired at this newspaper for decades for her bravery, her campaigning. She feels as well there's no accountability in the Met. She's unhappy about her son's murder inquiry being closed by
Stephen Lawrence.
Yeah, Stephen Lawrence last year. She has other issues as well against the current commissioner and her regime. Now, the other signatories include Harvey Proctor, you know, someone you've interviewed in the past.
Yeah.
He's got £500,000 compensation from the Met for the failures of the Nick scandal. But he, again, angry, there's been no accountability. The other sort of notable signatories, as you say, Lord Bramall's son, heartbreaking to hear what Lord Bramall was saying in his last few months to his son about the lack of accountability in the Met and the hurt he felt.
A great man, a war hero, was at the Normandy landings.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So, and Paul Gambaccini, as you say, you know, Radio 2 broadcaster
Radio 2,
and really Radio 4, distinguished man, a very passionate man.
Yeah, he is.
And
didn't work for years because of this.
Well, for years, taken off air. You know, talk about innocent before proven guilty, you know, complete reversal, the way he was treated by the BBC. And he feels very sore about that.
Yeah. And what's triggered this is the revelation that Cressida Dick is going to have her term as Metropolitan Police Commissioner extended for 2 years. The Home Secretary will have to clear that, Priti Patel, the London Mayor, Sadiq Khan. They say it shouldn't happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, I brought this group together last week at a house in Clapham, hence
the Clapham Seven.
They are now the Clapham Seven. It's an idea I had several weeks ago that I've been hearing these individuals' stories for years, and the whole issue of police accountability, the perception that there's a culture of cover-up. Well, Lady Britton has said that in an interview with me earlier this year. In June, a damning public inquiry report into the Daniel Morgan axe murder case spoke of a institutional corruption at the Met and attacked Cressida Dick for trying to thwart the inquiry. Andrew, that inquiry into that shocking case took 8 years, cost £20 million, And within 2 minutes, Cressida Dacre Ross has dismissed its findings. Frank, can I have a tax refund, please? Because yeah. that is... So, look...
Daniel Morgan's family is represented in
Alastair Morgan. In 34 years, Alastair Morgan has been fighting for justice, for accountability, in a case mired in allegations of police corruption. Now, it was on my mind several weeks ago. These people have got individual voices. Can I bring them together?
Yeah.
And it took a few weeks. They agreed to come together.
But when you read some of it, Stephen, about the failure of the Metropolitan Police for anyone to be fired or to apologise and all the rest of it, Leon Britton went to his death not knowing the police had already cleared him. You think we're talking about a banana republic, if I'm still allowed to use that expression.
Yeah.
You know, some dodgy despot in a third world country, not the Metropolitan Police, the home of the Bow Street Runners. You know, we're meant to be an example, an exemplar to the rest of the world.
Lady Britton told me, you would treat a dying dog better than the Met treated her husband in his last few weeks and months.
Isn't that appalling?
It is. Going back to the core issues, this group were brought together last week before it was known that Cressida Dacre is poised to get a 2-year contract extension. So the letter, when I brought that group together, and it's an extraordinary day, one of the most extraordinary days in my career of its type. Mm. At the end of it, people felt so passionate that they said, "We've got to actually have a common voice. We've got to write to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary with a list of demands." Yeah. And it's not just about Cressida Dacre's head going, because yes, she is a roadblock to reform and transparency in the Met, but there is a cultural problem, Andrew, in the Metropolitan Police in particular. It's almost like they use the slogan of Millwall Football Club, no one likes us, we don't care. Mm. They do what they want. And I'm really shocked that Priti Patel appears to have sanctioned this 2-year contract extension, because weeks ago, we were being informed by sources quite close to her that Cressida Dacre wasn't going to get one. So has she been overruled by Number 10? And that really, you know, it's a bit of an indictment of her, I'm afraid, that her lack of gravitas, really it should be the Home Secretary's decision.
Of course. Are the Labour Party saying anything? Well, useless opposition, I know.
Well, it is, yeah. We'll see. You know, she's a damaged commissioner.
She is.
She's a toxic character now. I've been doing this covering crime that Scotland Yard for 25 years or more. There's always something bad around the corner. From what we can see ahead, it's looking turbulent, and it could be even more turbulent. So we'll watch this space. She's a weakened commissioner. I'd say it's a shabby, lazy decision, if it's true, to give her a 2-year extension. And there's going to be, and there is, a lot of anger, and people entitled to feel angry about it.
Yeah, I quite agree. Stephen, it's a brilliant, brilliant operation today. There'll be more in the Mail tomorrow, more on Mail Plus. That is Stephen Wright, the Daily Mail's Associate Editor. Thanks for coming in. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free, in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The World Health Organization has called on rich countries with large supplies of corona vaccines to hold back from launching booster programs until the end of the year. Yes, in case you doubt it, they mean the United Kingdom, of course. But the British government says it's going to press ahead with plans to offer jabs for up to 35 million older and vulnerable people this autumn, and they want it all done by Christmas. I'm joined now by Paul Hunter, who is Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia and no stranger to this podcast. Professor Hunter, you're the expert. I have to say, I'm not quite in the over 65 category yet, but if I was, I bet I would want a booster.
Yeah, well, I certainly am in the 65 plus category, but only just. I think that there's a number of reasons why you might want to give booster vaccines, and probably the most obvious is that the first round didn't work as well as you would have liked, and there is a large number of people within that have already been identified by the UK that need boosters, and we're talking about people who are severely immune compromised, people on treatment for cancer, people on high-dose steroids who generally don't respond well to vaccines anyway. And I think that's, in my view, undebatable, and the government has already said that's going to happen. Once you move away from that, the two reasons for giving booster doses, first is that the vaccines are waning in their protective effect, which they are to a certain extent, and that the vaccines aren't as effective against new variants, such as the Delta variant, which they are not. But although the vaccines aren't as good at stopping infection, they are still just as good at stopping severe disease. And as far as we can tell at the moment, there's no real evidence that that protection against severe disease is waning. So ultimately, I think I would extend the range of people who would have a booster dose over what the government has already indicated a couple of weeks ago. I would certainly give it to the over 80s, I think, and also other people who are less immune compromised. People who've got severe obesity, they generally don't respond so well to vaccines anyway, so they probably do need a booster. Beyond that, I think the value of giving a booster campaign at the moment, with the evidence that we have so far, and don't forget, there is a study that is about to present data, so you know this might change everything. But at the moment, I think the evidence is that we don't really need more general booster dosing in this country, because at the moment there's no real evidence that giving a booster actually makes a substantial difference to controlling the spread of the virus. It probably has some value, but how important is still far from clear, I think.
Now the government had great success with the rollout of the vaccine over the summer, and we know that the vaccine has stalled a bit with people under the age of 30. Do you sense that if we are going to have boosters for people over 65, between 65 and 80, in addition to people over 80 and the people who've got underlying health issues, that they're doing that for more, I don't want to say political reasons, but they're doing it because they're not following the science in the way they might have been earlier, because as you're suggesting, the science isn't there to say that somebody at the age of 66 necessarily will benefit a lot from a booster.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I think I have every confidence in JCVI. I think JCVI, the Vaccines Committee, has made very good decisions at the moment. They've got access to data that that the rest of us haven't, including myself, and I think wait to see what they say and act on the advice of JCVI, which, when all said and done, is one of the most skilled groups of people on vaccine delivery pretty much anywhere in the world.
Just finally, Professor, of course, some people will be nervous. They will have seen that infections are creeping up. Schools are back now. There'll almost certainly be a surge in infections, as there was in Scotland, because the schools in Scotland went back sooner. It may be that the government, if they do give those booster jabs, do that just to try to restore confidence in the population, in the community, because we want people to go out. We want people spending money. We want them going to theatres and all the rest.
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of issues there, what you said. The first is, actually, within England, case numbers aren't dramatically going up at the moment. There's if you look at the PCR positive, only positives, that that probably have more relationship to clinical need, they've been pretty flat for the past couple of months. And you know, going up or down a bit, but generally not increasing dramatically. We don't know whether, once schools are back, now schools are back, whether cases will surge in the next few days. A lot of people have looked at Scotland and said that's the case in Scotland, but actually the big increases in case numbers in Scotland occurred before schools going back would have had any impact on the case numbers. So we're still in a very big uncertainty at the moment about how the infection will propagate itself over the coming weeks, and a lot of that we will have a lot more understanding about that within the next week or so. But the key message is that if you have had two shots of the vaccine, unless you are in one of these more highly vulnerable groups, you are very strongly protected against severe disease and needing to go into hospital. So the vaccines are still working incredibly effectively at protecting people against severe disease. And it's, you know, it's severe disease that matters to a large extent.
Well, that's very reassuring to hear. That's Paul Hunter, Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia, who tells us he's 65, even if he doesn't look it. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe. Then you can get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryboyPierce. So should Britain follow Portugal's example and decriminalise all drugs? A parliamentary report last year found the cost to the society of illegal drugs is about £20 billion a year. The former leader of the Conservative Party, no less, Lord Hague, says Britain should follow Portugal, who legalised personal drug use 20 years ago. I'm joined now by Dr. Robert Lefevre, who's an addiction specialist, a former GP, and author of The Streetwise Guide to Addiction. Dr. Robert, we've spoke before many times. Remind me your view about Britain's current drugs policy.
I very much support decriminalisation. I do not support legalisation. And the difference is this. If someone is caught using drugs, they should not be sent to prison. That's not going to help. They're going to learn even more about drugs and so on when they're in prison. But what they should ideally do is to be helped to go to rehab and become totally abstinent. So this is what they've got in Portugal, decriminalization. By contrast, what they had in Colorado and Washington State was legalization of cannabis. And that, the end result is the use of that has taken off. And people from all sorts of other states in the U.S. are getting their cannabis via Colorado and Washington. So legalization is not a good idea. But decriminalization, yes, I'm very much in favor of that. Because people who have an addiction problem are not well, they're ill. They have a problem with their mood centers of the brain. And they need help. They don't need just to go on and on using a drug. That's just another dependency. So whether it's a substitute that helps people to come off heroin and to avoid the damage caused by needle use, that I'm in favor of that. But they've got to be able to have the quality of life that they're looking for and not continued dependency.
Of course, the other thing, if you decriminalise, Doctor, is the gangs, and they're flourishing, they're making a lot of money. We've seen almost record numbers of teenagers, for instance, stabbed to death in London this year, most of that related to drugs. It would, if the decriminalisation comes in, would that, do you think, paid a lot to some of the gang culture? And also, might also lead to better drugs being given to drug takers? Well, better in the sense that they're not as dangerous.
That's a very attractive idea. Unfortunately, the experience, again, in Colorado and Washington State is that the illegal drugs are still doing a warring trade, despite the fact that they've got a legal option. People trust the illegal drugs more than they would trust the legal ones. So that's part of the problem. That a simple, straightforward solution doesn't always work.
Do you think that the government, successive governments, have lost the war on drugs in this country?
I don't think they've ever fought the war on drugs, because the only way to win is through complete abstinence and working the 12-step program, first formulated by Alcoholics Anonymous. My last use of any substance of addiction was 12th of October 1984. I'm 36 years completely abstinent. Well, that's just the starting position. What is really important is that in 2009, I was made bankrupt as a result of a fraud by my accountant. I lost absolutely everything, my home, my medical practice, my rehab, the lot. And yet I didn't relapse. And in 2010, my wife, to whom I'd been married for 48 years, died of a stroke.
Oh, dear.
I've been through both of those experiences and have not relapsed. So So what I'm doing now is writing and composing music every day of my life. And I'm still earning my living as a counsellor. So I've got quality of life, and that's what I want to see right across the board, not simply decriminalisation. That isn't sufficient. We want more than that.
That's Dr. Robert Lefevre, who's an addiction specialist, former GP, and author of, and you should read it, The Streetwise Guide to Addiction. So, extra bonus, we've got Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor in second day running, and he's clearly living the dream because he's in his sports gear.
I am. I've just cycled in, you see.
Very good.
So,
how long is the cycle ride?
It's about 20 minutes, so I haven't had a chance to... I didn't know I was going to be called in
well,
on this guest appearance.
Well, we just needed your expertise.
Well, it all helps the bank balance.
Yeah, right. That great, great story coming out of US Open, Flushing Meadows. Emma Raducanu, 18... first qualifier, I think, ever to get to the semi-finals of a US Open.
Yeah.
And she still hasn't dropped a set.
Still hasn't dropped a set, even in qualifying or in the tournament thus far. She played Bencic yesterday, who, you know, this was the big test.
She's the Olympic champion, isn't she?
She's the Olympic champion. This is the one we thought, well, this is a big step up for her. You know, this will prove her undoing. Now, as I said the other day, Bencic does have a habit of if she's pushed, she can crumble. But after the first game, when Raducanu lost her serve, she was broken in the first game. She was clearly a bit nervous, a little bit tight, hit a few into the net in the first game. Then Bencic held her serve to go 2-love up. From that point on, really, once Raducanu had got to grips with the pace of the ball and the depth of the ball from Bencic, she just took the game to her and, you know, absolutely, really destroyed her. Slight wobble. So won 5 games in a row in the first set. Again, when she gets on a roll, She won 11 games on the bounce in the previous match. Mm. 5 games in the first set to put that set to bed. And then broke her early, held a serve early in the second when she looked like she might be broken, and then went on to win the second set reasonably comfortably. And the other good thing was she closed it out. Now, you know, she's had some people have been mildly critical of her when she's got on the verge.
She's had 4 or 5 match points and she's fluffed them.
But I mean, blimey, you know, she's 18. This is uncharted
But she
territory.
Closed it out much easier, closed more easier yesterday.
Much easier, yeah. She was serving for the set, love 30 down, at which point she could have thought, crumbled, bounced back and then won it on her first match point. So, incredible performance.
So she's in the semi-finals. She now becomes the England number one tennis player, female, because Joanna Konta, has fallen out of the top 60. She's in the semi-finals against who?
So she's playing Maria Sakkari, who is a Greek player, 17th seed, 26-year-old, who overnight beat Pliskova. So that was an upset because she's the number 4 seed.
Right.
So, you know, Raducanu couldn't have scripted this much better in terms of, you know, who she would like to play in the semi-final. She'd have been, you know, I mean, blimey. Although you could say, well, it doesn't really matter. She's just beaten Bencic. She could have beaten Pliskova.
Yeah.
But, you know, if she'd had to choose, I suppose she'd have chosen the lower seeded player. So Sakkari, you know, is beatable, absolutely beatable for Raducanu, the way she's playing.
And who's in the other semi?
Well, and then she could be in the final again. So in the other semi-final, you've got Sabalenka, who's the second seed.
Right.
So she's from Belarus. And she's playing the 19-year-old Leila Fernandez, who's this other girl who's taking the tournament by storm.
Wouldn't it be great if those two were in the
final? Well, yeah, I think you've got to go back to something, like, I don't know how many years, I mean like 20 years since a very young Serena, who was a teen, playing against, I think, Kim Clijsters for the last time. Two teenagers were in a major final. So that would be fantastic. This Leila Fernandez has been brilliant as well. I mean, she's beaten en route Kerber, Angelique Kerber. She's beaten Osaka. Yeah, she's beaten Naomi Osaka, who's won the US Open in the past. To name but two, she beat another one whose name escapes me, another very good player.
Yeah.
So she's obviously fantastic and in fantastic form and fearless.
Yeah.
It just shows what you can achieve when you're fearless and 18, 19, isn't it?
What's your hunch? Can she do it?
I think she could beat Sakkari. I think she will beat Sakkari. Yeah. And I think it could well be that she gets to the final. I mean, it's very rare that a youngster gets to a final and wins it, because normally you need a couple of bites at the cherry before you can...
Because that's going to be very intimidating in the final, Flushing Meadows. Packed stadium.
Absolutely. In your first major, in your first final.
The crowd might be behind her.
Could be. Although, you know, depends who she plays. If she plays Leila Fernandez, the other 19-year-old, you know...
Where's she from?
She's from Canada.
Right.
So they could be split there. I mean,
the Americans won't cheer for Canadians.
They don't like the Canadians, do they? So they could go on Raducanu's side. If she's playing Sabalenka and she's a massive underdog, which she would be against Sabalenka, they'll 100% be on Raducanu's side.
Which is an advantage, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you've got the crowd on your side, it's a huge advantage. So, I mean, you know, it has been done before. Someone like Becker, you'll remember, won it as an 18-year-old out of nowhere. So it has been done, but it's rare. Normally, you need to get deep into these majors before you can then go and win it. Look at Andy Murray, for example. You know, how many times did he get to semis, to finals, before he eventually won it? Raducanu just rocks up and wins a second one.
Poor old Tim Henman never quite made the final, did he?
Well, Henman never made a final. Rozetsky made one final and lost at the US Open. So, you know, to think that she could go and storm her way into a final. I mean, great. She's a brilliant story. She seems like an absolutely lovely girl. No one on the circuit's got a bad word to say about her. She's incredibly popular.
To think just a few weeks ago, she was sitting her A-levels.
I know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? It is extraordinary. So, fantastic story. And obviously, you can, you know, we'll bring you all the coverage of it online and then in Saturday's paper, hopefully previewing the final.
Well, best of luck to her, Emma, and we wish all rooting for her. And that's Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood, looking very fetching in his cycling gear. So, there is another twist in the saga of Geronimo, the alpaca. Geronimo's owner, Helen McDonald, says a post-mortem on Geronimo, who was put down last week after a four-year battle with officialdom, had found no telltale signs of bovine tuberculosis. The government, of course, says it vets had found TB-like lesions in early tests. Helen McDonald is Geronimo's owner, and she joins me now. Helen, you're not giving up on this, are you?
No, I'm not. I still don't have any answers that are credible, really. First of all, as far as I'm aware, he wasn't put down. They haven't told me how, when, or where Geronimo died. Last time I saw, he was tied up in a horse box being strangled and suffocated. So, you know, I have no credible evidence to suggest that he got to his destination.
You're suggesting he might still be alive?
No, I'm suggesting that he died in the horse box when they took him from my farm. They will not confirm or give me any information. It's causing me huge distress. So there's that point. The second point is that the claims that are being made by DEFRA, particularly the statement yesterday, I strongly refute. There is nothing in there of any credibility whatsoever. For the chief veterinary officer, a vet, to not know the difference between an atypical lesion and a TB-like lesion beggars belief. And they're not giving me the information. I do not have a copy of the post-mortem report. I do not have any further test results that should be available by now. I do not have permission to have those samples sent to an independent pathologist. I did not get an independent witness at his post-mortem, which again raises questions as to why no one else could be involved with that.
Yeah, I should say, because Dr. Christine Middlemiss, she's the government's chief veterinary officer, says we've done the initial post-mortem. She's convinced they're right. Would it be expected to have an independent witness at a post-mortem like that, Helen?
Not expected, no, but it's not an unreasonable request given the circumstances. They say that Geronimo caught TB at a show in New Zealand six years ago. You know, and there's no credible test data to suggest that there was ever a suspicion of disease. So the whole thing has been about, it's not been about TB at all, you know. It's been about me asking a question and standing up for myself and the subsequent trauma that I've been dragged through for 4 years.
Would if Geronimo had TB, would Geronimo have got sick?
Yes. So, you know, animals, alpacas, don't typically live very long with TB.
Right.
This is a progressive wasting disease. That test that he supposedly failed 4 years ago was a late stage test. Now, if he, with all the stress that he's endured, being in isolation with female alpacas for 4 years, with all of those stresses and strains, our expert witnesses have testified in court that by now he shouldn't be alive, and he should certainly have had visible lesions in places that should be found.
That's what I was wondering. Where do you go with this, Helen? Because you can't bring him back. He's gone. Are you doing this on behalf perhaps of other owners? Because, of course, there's talk of another massive cull of badgers to try to prevent the spread of TB.
Of course. So, well, first of all, we have to get transparency and openness from government about Geronimo and the circumstances and the complete investigation as to why they decided to not be admit that they knew there was a problem with this test 4 years ago, right from the beginning. Okay, 4 years ago, their behavior and conduct needs a full investigation. Going forward, we know that at least 9 other camelids died the same way Geronimo did, having failed, supposedly failed Enfaplex testing following priming. There's those animals as well. Then there's just the testing policy in general and the fact that they're not able to rely on their own testing and post-mortem protocols, and they're not prepared to improve policies or change their attitudes. You know, this is a disease that can be managed, can be eradicated, and it's all it seems to us is the policies are not working and animals are being needlessly slaughtered while other ones remain infected. It's just, the whole thing's a mess, isn't it?
It is, Helen. Well, look, I wish you best of luck in your campaign. It's an ongoing battle. You're not giving in, are you? Anytime soon?
No, I'm not giving up. I want to know also why George Eustace is still in a job this morning. He's not only ignored me for 3 years, he has lied to the electorate. Why is he still in a job?
Yeah. Well, I've got to tell you, the political spies I hear is that George Eustace won't be in a job when the reshuffle comes, which could be in the next few weeks.
He's hanging on, though, isn't he?
They always do, politicians. On. They never know when to go, Helen. Helen, thanks so much for coming on. That's Helen McDonald, who is Geronimo's owner, who's fighting to keep his memory alive and trying to get answers to her questions. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and have a very good night.